is also a Kabbalistic idea. Okay, we're left again, we're on page 248. We're beginning the fourth book of the five books of Moses. And the book is called Bamidbar, and the Sedra, the weekly portion, is called Bamidbar as well. Actually, to be absolutely grammatically correct, it is actually Bamidbar, which means in the desert of. It's what's called the construct form. It's not just the desert, but the desert of. But because you can't say the desert of without saying which desert, we call the book Bamidbar, which means in the desert.
If it's the fourth book, does that mean it's Leviticus?
Leviticus is the third book.
Is it Numbers?
Numbers,
so
yes.
Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus,
no. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy.
Oh, I thought Leviticus was second to last.
No, you got the order slightly wrong. So this is the fourth, and in fact, you just alluded to the other name that it's got, even in Hebrew. It's called the Book of Numbers. Why is it called the Book of Numbers?
I was going to say, why is it?
In English, because, well, I'm not saying because it's called that in Hebrew, but it is as well. It's called Chomesh HaPikudim, which means the Book of Enumeration or Numbers. And the reason is very simple. If we open up and start reading, we read on this page that God commanded Moses to count the people, to count the Jewish people. Counting of the nation seems to play a very, very important part in Judaism. And the Medrash tells us that there have been 9 censuses, 9 countings of the Jewish people, and the 10th will take place when Mashiach comes, when the Messiah comes. So the idea of counting of the Jewish people, it seems to be a very fundamental concept. Now, together with that fundamental concept, there's also a dire warning. Because we know that counting can be a dangerous thing as well. So we're told that you don't count Jews like going 1, 2, 3. The only allowable way that we're allowed to be counted is indirectly through the aegis of the half shekel. Now, we have discussed this many times before because it comes around every year, at least twice. But the half shekel idea is that the way you count something, you can either count it directly. And so you have a herd of a flock of sheep, and you just count them. Well, the way the farmers do it is they put them through a gate. Yeah. You have them all in one field, and you open a gate, a small narrow gate that one sheep can go through, and one goes through at a time. And you count them, and then they end up in the other field. That's a way of counting a flock of sheep. So you're counting the actual objects. But the other way is, the Jewish way, is for each Jew to give a half shekel, which is a small coin. It doesn't break the bank. And these half shekels were then counted. So of course, once you know that everyone gave a half shekel, you just count the total amount, and you know how many Jews there were. And God warns very strongly, do not count them directly, lest a pestilence, you know what a pestilence is? A plague.
A plague.
Lest a plague will break out. Mm. And people will, you know, it's a disease that people die from. So it would seem that there's a very powerful...
You see people put their hands up, say who wants how many teas, how many coffees, and they put their hands up. Is that counting the person? And putting a hand up?
It's what you call a good shiloh, that. It's the way, I mean, the Jewish way of doing it. You know, we have to count a minion.
Yes.
We have to count 10 men for a minion.
Yeah.
Yes.
In shul. You can't start the service without 10 men. No.
Right.
So how do we count them?
No.
Do we go... We don't.
No.
What we do is we take a posuk, which is a sentence, a quote, from the biblical text, and the actual posuk usually chosen is Hoshea Samecha, and it's got 10 words in it. And then you can go around the room and go Hoshea Es Amecha Uvarech Es Nachlasecha. So I know where I've got to. Urim Manasseh Madaholam. That makes 10. 6 and 4 is 10. Mm. So you know how many you've got by how many how many words you got through in that sentence. So that's made it indirect, because you're not counting the people, you're counting the words of the sentence. Now your question is, if people put their hands up and you just count the hands, would that be okay? I've got a feeling it would be, you know, because you're just counting hands.
What about names?
Or names, yeah. As long as you don't go round.
Yes.
Pardon?
In a class, in a school, they have to
put your hand up.
Hand up. Every time a teacher asks a question, they put no, for the register when they come in.
Well, you can call the names in the register, that's not counting. You put the names, and down the side of the register there's a list of numbers, so you know how many kids are on the class. So that is not, you know, again, that's indirect. You've counted the names, and by the side of the names there's a number, so you're not counting the people. So, anyway, the parish, the text that deals with this dire warning, actually we learnt a few weeks ago, it's in the Cedric Isissa, which must be about 2 months ago, where God gives this method of counting the people. And there's a lot of tremendous powerful symbolism in this whole concept of the half shekel. Many questions are asked, why a half shekel and not a whole shekel? Since it's not a big coin anyway, it's like saying give me 5p or give me 10p. Neither of them are going to be a major issue with anybody, even the poorest person is going to be able to stick their hand in their pocket and pull out 5p or 10p. So why is it a half? This is one of the questions that's asked. And then it says that this half shekel is 10 gera, which is an even smaller coin. It's like 10p is 10 individual pence, right? So, and it says so, right? It says that the full shekel is 20 and the half shekel is 10. So what's the significance of these 10 smaller coins that make up the half shekel? And a lot of questions asked about it. So there's a tremendously powerful symbolism. I'll just give you one insight into it, which is talked about in Hasidic teachings a great deal, which is, you know, normally we don't find halves in Judaism. You know, normally Judaism advocates doing things wholly, not in halves. So why over here did God say just give a half? And one of the lessons of it is that everyone should know that we're really only just a half. We all need each other to complement each other, to complement us. Everyone needs someone else to complement. The Jewish people are one whole unit together because we're together.
People who need people.
And because we're acting as one, and we realize that we're not totally fulfilled on our own, and that we're only a half. That's a very powerful message as well. And the other thing is that there are 10 small coins in this half shekel, and that indicates that we know that in Hasidic teachings it explains that we have 10 soul powers, but we know that God also has 10 soul powers in a sense, and the two tens are also matching each other, so we're reaching up to God with our half shekel, which is 10, the number 10 small coins, gera, as I said, and God reaches down to us with his 10 to make the full complement of the whole coin. And so there's a lot of powerful symbolism there as well. But in this week's Sedra, it actually does not mention this method of counting. It's accepted that we already know that. It just talks about the idea of doing the actual count and giving us the final results on the numbers. So over here in this week's Sedra, we get in fact two enumerations of the Jewish people. One by tribe and then one by tribal formations, because they traveled in formation of three tribes in a group. Yeah, and in according to one opinion in box formation. So they actually march forward like, you know, like a military, you know, unit. They're marching forward on a broad front. And so the enumeration is given both as individual tribes and then three tribes together to make four separate units that acted together.
That's 12. What?
Yeah, so 4, 3 is 12, yeah. 12 tribes.
Right.
Yeah. So
what's the 10 souls that you just...
The 10...
Souls?
The 10 soul powers, I said. Not 10 souls, but 10 soul powers.
Which are...
Did you not come across it yet in Dr. Lerntal's Tanya class? Yeah, I mean, it comes up very often.
Yeah, we have done
that. It's explained in Hasidic and stroke Kabbalistic teachings.
Yeah, we've done that. We've talked about
that.
We
did
too.
We
only did
Okay.
That's the two souls that everyone has, the animal soul and the body soul.
Yeah, we forget that all the time.
So within each soul, there are 10 soul powers. The three intellectual ones, that's Chokhmah, Bina, Das, which means wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. And then you have... everyone's braving the rain. This is fantastic. Mm. You know, we get more people in the rain than we get in blazing sunshine. There's a chair over there, and a chumash over there as well. And then we have 7 emotional attributes or powers, and then starting with kindness, severity, beauty, and so on. Again, it would be quite a big digression to go into that now, but just take it for the moment. There are 10 soul powers. And that's represented by this half shekel with its 10 coins that it is made up of. So, as I say, very powerful symbolism and content and meaning behind this count. But in this week's Sedra, another aspect of it is stressed, which is the concept of counting itself. What is the significance of counting the Jewish people, that it plays such a major part in Jewish history and destiny? Why does God need to count us? A very simple question. Doesn't God know the numbers? We know God knows everything. Right? Nothing is hidden from him. He's the all-seeing eye, the all-hearing ear, the all-knowing, the almighty. He's all everything. He knows everything that's going on in this world. For sure he knows how many Jews there are. Right? So why does he need that count? Because who's asking us to be counted? He is. He's giving the command that we should be counted. And Rashi over, although we don't have the Rashi in this print, Rashi over brings out the point that he says that God shows his love for the Jewish people by counting them. Now that we do understand, because we do know that people that have collections, they like to count. You know, kids, they've got marbles, right? The bag of marbles, keep counting, make sure they've got all the marbles. You get people with coins, stamps, you know, they're always counting to see how much they've got. People have money. You know, the king was in his counting house, counting out his money. But something that's of value to you, something that you love and you're interested in, you're always interested in, are they all there? Have I lost any?
It's a reassurance of a
so
as well.
In that, even though God doesn't need to know, because he knows already, the act of counting demonstrates his love. Even though, again, the collector might know that he's got so and so many stamps in the album, but he counts them again just to express that tremendous love and interest he's got in it. So that's not such a big question as to why God wants to count us. But there's another aspect to it as well, which is, when we look at the Jewish people, we find that we are varied and there's a kind of hierarchy. Let's put it like that. Let's take a very simple hierarchy. There are different types of Jewish divisions. Kohen is a Kohen, right? A priest. Levi is a Levite. And Yisrael is an ordinary Israelite. You're a Levite? Yes. So, you know what I'm talking about. And each one has a different status. And they might be superior and inferior status. Like we know that the priests have a higher role to play within Judaism. And within the priestly grouping, you have the high priest, who's an even higher level. You know, one of the leaders of the nation, the Kohen Gadol, right? The high priest. He's one of the leaders of the nation. Then you have the king. Then you have princes of the tribes. Then you have the leaders of the Sanhedrin, of the Supreme Court of 70, which met in Jerusalem. And surely they are, you know, the greatest leaders, judges and so on in the nation. So we see these grades and distinctions between the people. And that implies there is a hierarchy. We can't get away from that fact. Judaism does believe in a hierarchy. And it's not true that everyone is equal in a total sense. However, there is one essential unifying factor of every single Jew, which is the same for everybody. And that's what the counting brings out. Because when you number something, what are you doing when you count? You're basically saying, I'm only interested in one thing about this group. I'm not interested in the individual superiority or inferiority or their intellect or their soul powers or their capabilities and their gifts and whatever people have as individuals. I just want to know of the existence of these individuals. Because really, when you boil everything down, the real essence of the Jew is his Jewish existence. And that Jewish existence comes from his Jewish soul, or her Jewish soul, no difference between a man and a woman, as far as the Jewish soul is concerned. And that Jewish soul that every single Jew has got is part of God. So what the counting does is, it brings out this essence. It focuses really on the essence of the Jew, that he is just a Jew. It doesn't ask, are you a high priest? Are you a hewer of wood or a drawer of water? What are you? No, I'm not interested in what you are. I just want to know that you are a Jew who has a Jewish soul that in turn is a part of God. And that's it. And that really is the very essence of what a Jew is. And is really the part of a Jew that is inviolate. It can never be destroyed. In Tanya, which you're going to be learning later with Dr. Lowenthal, it explains that it says over there that this Pint of the Yid, as it's called in Yiddish, that means the point of the Jew, the essence point of the Jew, is so powerful that even a Jew who is totally lapsed in their observance of Judaism, and that means they're just Jewish in name only, when they are challenged, their very Jewishness is challenged, they will rise to the occasion and are even capable of giving their lives for God, even though they're not observant in their daily lives. They don't show their religiosity in their daily lives. There's a very powerful story told at the time of the destruction of the temple by the Romans. This is a medrash, which brings out this point. A medrash, which is actually on one of the sedrash we read in the winter. It says that when Isaac was blessing his son Yaakov, his son Jacob, it says, Vayorach es reach begodav. He smelt the smell of his clothes. Now the story behind that is, very quickly, that he was wearing Esau's clothes in order to pretend not to be Jacob, but to pretend to be Esau. Because Isaac had said he was going to bless Esau, and Rivka, Rebecca, their mother, told Jacob, no, you're the one to deserve the blessings. I want you to go instead. So Jacob said, how can I go? He'll recognize me. So she said, put on Esau's clothes and also put on a goat skin on your arms. You'll feel hairy and he'll think it's, he, your father, will think you are Esau. Now Esau's cloak, we are told, came from originally from Adam in the Garden of Eden. And then there's a whole story how it went from one to the other, but it ended up in Esau's hands. So this cloak or outer garment which Esau wore regularly smelled of the Garden of Eden. Whatever that smell is, I assure you it's a very nice smell. I've never smelt it, but we are assured it's a very nice smell. So we're told that Isaac smelled the smell of his clothes. The smell, Rashi says, the smell of the Garden of Eden came in with him. And this actually made him raise his eyebrow, because Esau, he knew, was a bit of an iffy character. So how can he smell of the Garden of Eden? True, he had a coat like that, but still. So the Medrash on this says an amazing statement. Do not read it begodav, which means his clothes, but read it bogdav, which means his traitors. Meaning, now, and he smelt the smell of his traitors. Hang on, what does that mean? What traitors? What it means is that Isaac foresaw that Jacob, his wonderful, righteous son, is going to generate a nation. And this nation is going to be very varied in its activities. We're going to have the best of the best and the good of the good, and we're going to have the bad of the bad and the worst of the worst. But Jews are a very wide spectrum, and some Jews have got up to some really nasty tricks. Right?
That's a fact.
So we have, within the Jewish people, throughout Jewish history, we've had examples of really rotten people. And that's why they're called bogdim in Hebrew, which means traitors. And that's what it says. He smelt the smell of his traitors. But it sounds like he smelt it in a positive sense. In a sense, that just like the clothes smelt of the Garden of Eden, the traitors also smell of the Garden of Eden. They've got a good side to them. And then the Medrash goes on to tell this amazing story. It tells a story of how the Romans came to the temple. And they were on the verge. They wanted to, they'd already conquered Jerusalem. And they were coming up to the temple, and that was their next target. They want to conquer and destroy the temple. That's what they did in the end. But they knew that this temple was full of golden treasures. We read a few weeks ago the golden menorah, and the golden table, and the golden ark, and the golden altar. It was full, linings of gold, and unbelievable opulence in that temple, and they wanted it. But they were scared to go in. These Romans, they knew that there's a great spiritual power inside this temple. And they were scared to go in. Very understandable. So they thought, what can we do? You know what? We're going to get a Jew to go in. So I can't remember his name now, but one of the Jews in Jerusalem, they got hold of him and they said, look, we're going to offer you a big prize. If you go into the temple and bring out the golden treasures, you can have the first one that comes out. Or maybe the last one that comes out. I can't remember it. In order to get him to go in and bring them all out, I had to be the last one. So, no, it ended up, I think the Medrash says it was the first. You get the first, and then you'll bring out the rest for us. Well, that sounds fantastic. You know, he knew the value of these treasures. You know, a solid gold menorah worth millions. You know, gold's at their highest value for 25 years at the moment, $700 an ounce. So, gold is worth money. You know, a heavy gold piece, wow, he'd be a millionaire overnight. So, you know what? He goes in. Isn't this a traitor? A Jewish traitor? Going in and stealing the things from the holy temple and taking out and giving and wanting to give to the Romans. So he comes out with whatever it was. And I can't remember what. And they, of course, they tricked him. Because they wanted him to go in again and get the rest. So they took it from him. And they said, we'll give you the next one. And he realized he'd been duped. But now, when he started to they said, this time, you better go in whether you like it or not. Now that you've gone in, and you've shown that you can go in, you go in and you get the rest, or else. So now he was on the spot. So what did he do? What do you think he did?
Went in and stayed in.
He refused.
Oh.
He said, once I'm prepared to risk angering my God, but a second time I will not do. And they said, if you don't go in, we're going to torture you, we're going to kill you, we're going to do everything to you. He said, I don't care what you do, I'm not going in. And he refused point blank, and they tortured him and they killed him. So this, says the Medrash, is an example of a Jewish traitor. He went that far to be a traitor, to go into the Holy Temple and bring out golden vessels. But when he came to the moment and he realized what he'd done, because there's nothing like doing something wrong for a person to realize they've done something wrong, and then they asked him to do it again, that he balked and said no. Even though it cost him life and torture, which is very often worse than death. It describes what they did to him. I can't remember the details. So then, now the Medrash says, now we can understand why Isaac was saying, in a positive sense, I smell the smell not just of his clothes that came from the Garden of Eden, but I smell the smell of his traitors. They also give God a lot of pleasure as well, because ultimately a Jew will not make the ultimate denial of God when he's really pushed his back against the wall. And that is the Pintaliyut. That's this point of Jewishness which is inside each and every one of us. And what brings that out? Counting. Because the counting is saying, I'm not looking at all the differences. Are you a tzaddik or you're not a tzaddik? Are you good or you're not so good? Are you learned, not so learned? God says, I'm just interested in the fact you're all my Jewish people with that spark of godliness inside each and every one of you. And for me, that is enough. Because that's the essence of the Jew. That's what connects you and me. And that's what brings out God's love for us, because it transcends everything else. You can be clever, less clever, learned, less learned, observant, less observant, righteous, less righteous. But this essence will never ever disappear. So that is one of the powerful messages behind the counting at the beginning of this week's study.
It makes a lot of sense.
How are we doing for time?
It makes a lot of sense.
A few more minutes before Dr. Lowenthal comes and calls me out. You have a question, okay?
It would be difficult to have this discussion outside of a Jewish circle. And
you mean talking about the power of a Jew and the special nature of the Jewish soul? That's a very good question, which has been dealt with. Because actually, this is actually a Talmudic statement, and it appears in Tanya as well, so extensively.
There's a lot of people who would object quite strongly to making, especially with racial tension and all of that type of stuff.
Yeah, I hear what you say. It's as they say nowadays, it's not PC. You know what PC is?
Yes, but we don't need to say it outside, do we?
Well, the thing is, should we be ashamed of saying it outside?
No, but it's not. I don't think we should, actually.
The Rebbe was actually asked this question.
People I don't think that wouldn't understand. There's all kinds of comments that have gone past me over the years.
Your situation, unfortunately, your situation doesn't apply, like it's there, but like to everybody, everyone's at different circumstances may not find, that.
Well, I'll give you a very simple answer to your
question. I've never found anything.
The last thing that Judaism can be accused of is racism. Mm. Because Judaism is actually an open religion. Mm. Racism would say there's an innate superiority of this nation, or this tribe, or this, like the Aryans and the Germans and so on. And they're innately superior. They are the Herren folk, the superior nation, the master race, that's translation of Herren folk, which is German. And all the rest of you are plebs, you're all inferior, untermenschen, etc.
Plebs.
And there's no hope for you. We're the master race. And you're the plebs, and we're going to be the masters, and you'll be the slaves, and that's the way it is, we can't do anything about it. Now,
but don't the Jewish...
What?
Sorry.
Let me just answer. What does Judaism say? Judaism says, whatever we are, and whatever we describe ourselves as, and whatever we claim for ourselves, which is not really our claim, you only have to look in the Chumash to find this. Because in the Chumash it says, about us, right? And that's the Chumash is the Bible, right? The five books of Moses. When God told Moses to go and speak to Pharaoh to let his children go, he said to Moses, go and tell Pharaoh, let Bani Bechari Yisrael, my son, my firstborn Israel, let my people go. He introduced to Pharaoh, this is God speaking, and I'm telling you, my son, my firstborn Israel, you've got them in slavery and I want them out. He's introducing to Pharaoh, God's describing us as his son, his firstborn Israel. And later on in the Chumash, it describes us as Bonim Atem Lashem Lekechem. You are the sons or children of the Lord your God. So that's a claim not made by us. That's text that comes, part of the revelation of God to Moses. However, what I was going to say was, as a very simple answer, is that Judaism's actually open to everybody. You can become Jewish. So whatever someone says, how can you possibly claim this superiority, which we could debate the superiority, because really the truth is that Judaism is actually giving us, as the rabbis put it, they say, we're not giving you royalty, we're giving you slavery. We've become God's servants. You know, we've got a special role to play with superior responsibility, you know, more responsibilities than other people. What are we claiming for ourselves? We're not lording it over people. We're saying we've got more to do than other people. God's demanding more of us than other people. Mm. That's a kind of claim which most people wouldn't want to share.
No.
Most non-Jews say, well, Judaism sounds a bit tough for me. Mm. You know, there's a Yiddish saying, schwer zu sein a Yid, it's hard to be a Jew. It's hard because there's a lot demanded of us. So our superiority, in inverted commas, is expressed in more demand upon us. But I still haven't got to the nub of the point, which I already alluded to, which is, it's open to all. We're not a missionary religion. But if anyone comes along and says, look, I've heard that the Jewish people are claiming that they're God's children and you have a special soul, can I join? 100% you can join. We discourage them. We discourage them because it's hard. Any non-Jew that comes along and says, look, it's not easy to be Jewish. You'll even get persecuted. Even converts got persecuted as well in Jewish history. So we say to the convert, think before you do this. But if you really want to and you're really sincere, you can do it. And we have all colors of Jews. There's lots of black Jews, genuine black Jewish converts, and some Lubavitch are blacks in New York. They're black. I've seen them. They look like Lubavitchers with the hat and the beard and the gattle, you know, the black belt around them. They look the same as everyone else.
Because they're black, it still doesn't.
And they're accepted. And in Israel, there's thousands of them.
What about the Falashes?
And the Falashes. And we have. There's a book called The Bamboo Cradle, which some of you may have read, about a little baby that was found on a bench in a railway station in China by an American Jewish university lecturer who was working in China for a few years. And he found this bundle on the thing and he took it home. Turned out to be a baby girl, and he ended up adopting her, brought her home to America and converted her to Judaism. Now she's married, she lives in Israel, she married a normal Jewish guy, and she looks Chinese.
But can they convert a baby?
Yeah.
I thought they had to be to a certain age.
No, they can convert a baby just that when they get to Bar or Bas Mitzvah, they have to be asked, do you really want to continue?
Oh, I see.
Otherwise they can be converted. So there's this girl, who I can't remember her name now, but she goes around the world lecturing about her experiences.
She's
as
this
a
week's
Chinese...
Yes?
This week's what?
Mishpacha.
I think she was, she was cited in one of the recent ones.
You said that we're not superior and so on, but there are some Hasidic people that say that we are better than everyone else, and they've gone...
Well, in a way, we've just been saying...
Nothing. Is that right?
No, that should never be said.
I've heard it.
I was very bored this weekend, and I actually went on these white nationalist websites and spent like the whole weekend arguing in text with them. And
what did you call them? White nationalists.
And you know, and I'm just like, I called myself Anonymous Hebressa or something like that. At some point, it was all peaceful at first, and I was just making some points. But somewhere along the way, and some of them sounded nice. I mean, they're nuts, but. And then someone starts, you know, dredging up all these quotes from sources I've never heard of, that like, you know, the goyim have no soul, and you know, this is what you people say, and I'm like, well, I don't know about
Nowhere does it say a non-Jew doesn't have a soul. They also have a soul.
I've heard terrible things some Hasidic people have said. I've been shocked. I said, why do you say the goyim are nothing? Because we have the Torah. I don't know.
Well,
you mustn't say other people are nothing.
They're not. They can't be nothing because they can soon be. You know, first of all, they have certain commandments that apply to them, so they can't be nothing. God wouldn't give commandments to a non-entity.
The seven laws of the apply
to the non-Jews. Then you've got a concept of what's called Hasidim Mesa'olam, which means the righteous Gentiles, who Maimonides says have a share in the world to come. Then you have the concept of conversion, that they can convert to be Jew, to be Jewish. Then you have a concept that a non-Jew has a task and a role in the world. And if they fulfill their role and task the way they ought to, the way God planned it for them, they are perfectly righteous and perfectly fulfilled. God has a plan for everybody. And then also, they're part of the messianic plan also. Because ask these Hasidim that say they're nothing, why does it say in the Aleinu prayer that we want the whole nation, not the whole nation, the whole world, all the nations of the world, to bow down to God? And he says, all knees will kneel to you, all tongues will swear to you, and the whole world will be put to rights in the kingdom of God. And why does it say in the book of Psalms, Hallelujah Hashem Kol Goyim, praise God all ye nations? Psalm 117, I think it is. It's the smallest psalm, by the way. It's only got two sentences in it. Praise God all ye nations. If they're nothing, what does God want their praise for? So, a lot of these statements are, to me, the reason for these statements is because of the length of the exile, and we've had lots of suffering at the hands of the non-Jews. So it does have an effect. You know, it's hard to still maintain one's feeling of positivity to people who have... I mean, you're talking about Hamishpacha. There was an article in there about some Poles that had murdered a Jewish family, and he went back and met the murderer of his grandfather. Yeah. Mm. You know, Poles that, just for money, a few zlotys, as he put it, murdered his grandfather and all his family. Mm. And he met the man face to face, a 92-year-old, who admitted it in front of a camera.
But he didn't know who he was talking to.
He didn't know who he was talking to. Mm. So, that, you know, when we have this in Jewish history, time and time again, it's very hard for people who have actually suffered from it personally. Mm. Many of the people in Stamford Hill are children, or at least grandchildren of Holocaust.
Well, I am, but I don't and talk like that. I wasn't brought up
okay,
like
so
that.
Okay, so you don't, but it's understandable you get that kind of attitude.
And there are small Hasidic groups, I don't want to say which ones, and maybe they haven't mixed with the world at all.
Yeah, I mean, it is understandable. After centuries and millennia of suffering. But I have just proven to you, with a number of quotes, that it cannot be true. Now the question of what is the nature of the Jewish soul, and what's the nature of a non-Jewish soul, and how they relate, you know, we'll leave that for the books of Hasidism. But I do assert that it's something we could talk about in a non-Jewish. I'm happy to talk about it in a non-Jewish audience.
Because if we don't want things to be said against us,
say over the things
I
say,
isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I say to them, if you feel that there is an element of superiority here, come and join us. We've got no problem. Now, I'd go and ask an Aryan whether he'll say that. The Heron folk, the master race, would they say, you know, all the Jews, you can come and join us if you want.
It doesn't exist anymore.
Or the Gypsies or whatever.
They don't exist.
Well, the Aryan thing, that's not the focus of these nutty white nationalists, but